Hi, friends. This is Armand DeMille. You're going to be listening to four CDs, which were made from audio cassettes, because this was originally recorded at a time when CDs were not available. And these audio cassettes were also recorded at a time when I was doing my program, The Positive Mind, every Wednesday, just one day a week. So you can hear a lot of references to that. You may hear other references to turn the tape over and things like that. We're trying to edit as much of it as we can. What has happened is that these four audio tapes, which are now turning into CDs, have become very important learning, and I think that you're going to get a lot out of them. You're going to have to deal with a lot of things, including maybe some sound level variations, but it's highly worth it, very, very much worth it. So, here we go.
Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. Every Wednesday here at WBAI at 1 p.m. And over the next few weeks, we're going to be looking at your relationship with success. Why you may or may not sabotage yourself, if it is sabotage. It's going to take me a couple of weeks or maybe 3 weeks to cover that completely with you, today being the first. But before we do, some responses to your many letters. If you have a question to ask me and you want to write to me here at the station or at my office, please be sure to include your phone number so that I can call you back. I can never write back to all of you, but 5 or 10 minutes on the phone I have for anybody. Today, we're going to be looking at the underpinnings of most people's distress from a point of view that's made a big difference to me and my work as a psychotherapist and my personal life as well. So I'm going to use my personal experience as a way of communicating this stuff to you. And in doing so, we're going to all take a trip back to 1987. There it was, 1987. I was at the top of the heap. I was sought after psychotherapist, teacher, lecturer, supervisor, TV and radio guest personality. I was at a keynote speaker in Philadelphia. The audience of about 600 people looked dreadful. They were kind of, you know, that isolated, remote, suspicious crowd that you run into frequently at health fairs. Little wonder why, you know, when they're going to a place where they expect to find answers and instead they get some buy my product and save your life hustle that you'd expect to find on the Home Shopping Network, you know. They were dark, serious, and skeptical. Who blames them? So I decided to open my lecture with a joke. And I have favorite jokes that I use from place to place that usually fit the audience and start the internal journey of self-curiosity that I love to engender in people. I have 5 favorite jokes. So see if you can remember them from having heard me over the years. The three-legged chicken joke. You remember that one? The Picasso. The somebody up there joke. The knock-knock joke. And the kielbasa joke. Maybe I'll tell a few today. So I started, actually I will tell one, I'll tell you the three-legged chicken joke that I told there in Philadelphia, sitting there, 1987, there I am, featured keynote speaker. I get up on the podium with this very depressed crowd of a bunch of people, you know, looking and they're saying, oh, I know he's famous, but he's probably going to lie to me too. So I started with a three-legged chicken joke, and just to lighten the mood in the auditorium, in 1987, chicken was seen as a new discovery. You know, they had just discovered chicken, and an alternative to the cholesterol beef, and the true vegans were in a majority at health fairs. So a chicken joke seemed appropriate. Here's a joke. I was driving down a country road when alongside me, running at a high speed, appeared a three-legged chicken. It passed me like a roadrunner, you know. I followed it, and I turned into a farm, and I drove up to the main house and was greeted by the farmer. And I said to the farmer, I just saw a very, very fast three-legged chicken run into your farm. He says, oh, yeah, we breed them. And I said to him, three-legged chickens? I said, they're very fast. He said, yeah. I said, why did you breed a three-legged chicken? And he said, well, you see, it's me, my wife, and my daughter, and we all like a chicken leg. So we couldn't see killing two chickens to have one dinner, so we bred these three-legged chickens. And so now my wife can have a leg, and I can have a leg, and my daughter can have a leg. And I said to him, that's amazing. How do they taste? And he says, I don't know. I haven't been able to catch one yet. That's the story I told in 1987. The audience liked it. They cracked up. They thought it was kind of funny. So I thought that I'd keep my audience in an even higher, let's not take it all so seriously mood, and I threw them a one-liner. I said, well, we finally isolated the primary cause of cancer. It's sleep. Sleep causes cancer. I expected everybody to crack up. In 1987, we had just discovered that sex could be deadly, the ozone was being destroyed by hairspray, and most water was undrinkable. So I thought that people would get a kick out of the ridiculous. Sleep, our last safe refuge, you know? But instead of laughing, they simply nodded in despair and started taking notes. And I knew we were in trouble. Mostly I was shocked by the fact that my reputation had grown to the point that people were listening to me with such an authority that even for a moment they were ready to accept anything that I said as, you know, the word of God. They were writing it down. And I knew that I was at that crossover point, that time of success in life where you lose sight of people. You begin believing that you may be God, or God's voice may be channeled through you, you know, that kind of stuff. I'd seen it before in many of my friends and associates. I saw the gifted ones who had come, who had some extraordinary talents. I saw them climb onto their mighty horses and get further and further away from the fact that they were just human, just another person, with a little extra dose of talent or smartness. And I felt it happening to me there in 1987. I saw the adoration and the fear as people tried to get close to me. And I always tried to bring myself down to earth, but somehow the temptation to ride the crest was always in the background. So here I was. I had gone from being a talented mental health practitioner and theorist to becoming a sage, because people were writing down the things I said, you know. Someone whose every word got written down. And I wondered how long it would be before I started to really believe that every word I had to say was real wisdom. Was I going to take my speculations and do like the others, turn them into facts? It's such a trap. You parents know about it. When your child starts believing that you know everything, and you get that tiny temptation to slide a little self-serving information to your son or daughter and make it more important than it is. You know, you may say something like, children who don't clean their rooms have their arms and legs fall off while they're asleep, or something like that, just so that the kids will clean the room. So the trap is always there for anybody who succeeds in life, and that's why I had my six friends up here during the fun drive, you know, that fun drive we did 2 weeks ago. I wanted you to see the people, not the wisdom. These were folks who I believe did not fall into the trap of being a know-it-all. These were six people, I think, who survived it, who became successful, who stayed humble enough to only present the knowledge that they applied to themselves. Some of you have met them. You know, they're good folks. I remember it was Dr. Cherry Quincy, Joe Turkel, Jeanette Mason, Anita Eisenberg, William Astwood, Carol Schwartz. Good folks who don't sell a theory. They don't offer things they can't produce. And they don't turn theory into fact. That's why I love and I respect even you, you know, Sane, the scientist who calls me every now and then, you know, who feels that it's his job to keep me on my toes. Well, Sane, this show is for you. By the way, if you missed that show, we edited the 4.5-hour special down to about 2.5 hours. And the tapes are available and they're great. Six smart people telling us what they believe are the primary rules of life. And not just psycho-hogwash theory, but lessons that they've used in their own lives, and lessons that have served them well. You can get copies of that 2-hour special by calling my office, 757-4488. And you should know that the proceeds from the sale of these tapes goes right back into funding the materials we use for the WBAI donor drive, so it's kind of a circle. And while we're on the subject, special thanks to the crew at 3DB Sound, the company that reproduced those tapes for the donor drive, for turning their profit margin over to WBAI as a donation. They're really good folks there, too. Okay, and
back with you as I go off on my edges here. And by the way, Ginger, I got your letter. One more tangent and then I'm going back to the subject. Got your letter. Ginger's a wonderful lady out there in New Jersey who's done a lot here for BAI. And I have a question about your request, so call me at my office. There's something I want to clarify about it. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Wonder where we're going? In a roundabout way, I'm presenting you with some stuff for your consideration. We're talking about grandiosity, success, narcissism, and telling jokes. The bottom line here is that there's a trap that we fall into as we become adults, especially when we begin to succeed in our life plan. And I'm starting off with this personal story that led me to investigating how we get swept into becoming who we are not, and how we become trapped by our trappings. It happens to almost everyone who's born with that special edge, that little extra special something that's noticeable when you're young. I call this line of inquiry the drama of the gifted child, taking the title from Alice Miller's book, which I'll talk about a little later, which probably applies to almost all of you out there. You know, if the current Gingrich Senate hearings to do away with public radio because it's targeted to the intellectually elite, I mean, that means you know, the intellectually elite. Well, maybe elitism is a bad word, but if you are the intellectually gifted, therefore you are a BAI listener. Therefore, if you listen to WBAI, you must be smart. So you don't have to go to school. Just listen to BAI, according to Gingrich or Grigich. So, anyway, what does this all have to do with the original subject? Grandiosity, narcissism, success, a lot. And that's what I'm going to be getting to you over the next few weeks. You see, all this is about our desire to succeed and how and why we sabotage ourselves. So you know about it. Don't you ever see yourself sabotaging yourself as you start to achieve your goals? You finally find the perfect mate and some impulse gets you to create some issue to fight about, you know, to separate about. You get indignant or you get wounded or you get angry. Or finally you get the recognition you've been waiting for at your work, you know, and you decide to take a vacation and go off to Europe for 2 months instead, you know, just at the point of where you're at your height, instead of following through on what you're doing. Or finally you get out of debt and then you do something silly like buy a house and then start to struggle all over again to keep up the payments. Or you go on a diet and you hit the perfect weight and then you bust out and binge. Well, I believe that the reason we sabotage ourselves is because we're smart, not because we're stupid. I suspect that aborting our goals may be the smartest thing we could do at any given time. So before I go further, I want to continue with my 1987 story, and I want to hear from you now. I want you to call me up with some examples of when you finally got what you always hoped for. The telephone number here is 2793400. When you reached for a goal, got it, and somehow got out of it. These are probably behaviors on your part that you regret, but share them with me and I could guide the discussion over this week and the next 2 weeks around it so I can make sure you get answers to it. 2793400. I want to hear from you. What goal did you set for yourself that you sabotaged when you reached it, as you began to touch it, as you began to reach it? All right, let me talk to a couple of you. Boy, these people wait right away. All right, I'll jump on because they know they're safe being with me. Hi there, you're on the air. This is Armand DeMille.
How you doing, Doc?
Hi.
Well, I'll tell you, I had an interesting experience once, and I was in the National Guard, in New Jersey National Guard, and I had to spend some weekend time down at Fort Dix. And being a Jewish soldier, in the days where my father was a soldier, and there was a draft, there was approximately the same number of Jewish soldiers in the Army as the general population. But in the days of the volunteer Army, there were just not as many Jews, and sometimes going to synagogue at Fort Dix could be a pretty lonely thing.
Mm-hmm.
I remember once I was down there, and I met a young lady by the name of Linda, and she was a Jewish soldier from Florida, and I was smitten, quite literally smitten with her. Unfortunately, things the way they are with soldiers in basic training, it's generally not considered to be a good thing. I was not in basic training. She was. So So there was this element of forbiddenness which really made it much more intriguing.
Yeah, it's anti-Smittenism.
Yes. But we saw each other after that, and I was really I felt like this was the person that I was looking for my whole life. And then something happened where she was transferred to Turkey. And that's a long way off. You know, if Linda were transferred to, say, Fort Sam Houston in Texas, well, I could take a long weekend and go see her in Texas.
Right.
But not so in Turkey. That's a long way. So she went off to Turkey, and we wrote letters back to each other, and I was really looking forward to when she was coming back, but she wasn't coming back. She was there over a year, and I had started dating other women, and I met another woman. And I don't know what came over me, but I thought that it would be the smartest thing in the world to do to tell Linda that I was seeing another woman after having this correspondence.
Uh-huh. Boy, that's a perfect example of what I'm talking about.
Isn't it, though?
Yeah, no, it is. And Linda...
It was astounding. And I said, you know, I really should... You know, I want to be honest with Linda. I want to share everything with her. So I should tell her that I'm seeing this other woman. Needless to say, that was... I guess about 9 years ago, and I still haven't heard back from Linda.
Really? Well, maybe we'll have to... Do you know where Linda is nowadays?
I couldn't guess.
Well, maybe we have to send her a copy of this tape. We could track her down through the Army, can't you?
At this point, I mean, I'm married and have a baby on the way.
Well, call her and tell her anyway. I mean, you began telling her the whole truth.
Twice.
Right, do it twice. But, you know, now this is a point. What's your first name?
Mitch.
You know, you make my point perfectly.
Yeah.
Here you were, you know, with this person, kind of smitten, and a part of you, at this distance, says, well, I want to be honest, and I want to be honest, and so I'm going to be honest, and what you did instead was, in effect, end the relationship by doing something that obviously was not timely or not the correct time if you wanted to keep the relationship.
Right.
Right?
Absolutely.
I thank you for that example. I promise you, before the end of next week, you're going to settle this issue in your heart. Because I'm going right to that kind of feeling that you're talking about.
I promise to listen, but
okay.
I have to say, I'm surprised that I... It's really interesting how ambivalent I feel about it, now that you mentioned, you know, sending a card to her. There's part of me which would love to take, I don't know what it would take, a few hours, searching on the Internet, searching the phone books, calling the Army, to find out where she is.
Sure, there's a part of you that wants to settle it.
And there's a part of me that says, gee, get it over... And, you know...
And I understand.
...woman has had nothing to do with me for, you know, so long.
I understand, Mitch. Keep listening, you know, and if you're not going to be around next week, make sure you set up your tape recorder to tape the program.
I sure will.
Okay, because I'm going to address that. I'm going to save that as one of my notes.
All right, thanks a lot.
Sure. Hi, 2793-400, Armand DeMille.
Hi, Armand. How you doing?
Good.
My name is Samuel, actually. My African name is Ensara.
Ensara, hi.
And maybe a little bit more... I guess what you say, traditional, probably. I tend to be very, very eclectic in nature, okay? I've got about, oh, I don't know, maybe 27, whatever, different pursuits. Everything from writing to playing the flute to doing meditation, a lot of other things. And I, like you said, I can usually do them pretty successfully. I find that what happens to me without, if I can be specific if you want, but I find that I'll begin a project, and I'll write down all of the different methodology that I'm about to use to get into that project. And then somewhere within a month or two, I look back and I realize that I took a couple of steps, and somehow or another, it just never got, it never even got into a middle. When I was younger, it probably went further. Now as I've gotten older, I find less and less of even, you know, getting past the initial beginning.
Uh-huh. I understand. And that kind of addresses this question. Is what we're doing, you know, and I mean, there's like a lot of reasons behind it. High energy people tend not to complete things in detail. Now, that's one, and I know you're a high energy person.
Yeah.
So that's one item right there. But there's this other aspect which I'm going to be exploring, and this is a perfect example. The person who has their fingers in a lot of pies and doesn't kind of, you know, get one done or another done, kind of moves along. And as you get older, which is intriguing, they don't go that far anymore.
Yes.
They don't even get to the point of middle involvement.
exactly.
Okay, I've got it. I appreciate it, Ensor. I want to take that and keep that example, and I'll come back to it over the next 2 weeks.
I'll be listening.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
2793400, Armand DeMille. Hi there. You're on the air.
Hi. In response to what this gentleman was just saying, what I've realized in my life is that I'll come to those situations, you know, where I accomplish what I want to up to a certain degree, like you said, a month. But mm-hmm. then after that, realize that I let it go because I'm afraid of the failure part of it.
Mm-hmm.
No, and since, you know, you have that edge, you have that strength to get to wherever you want, you just don't want to, you don't want it to turn out like it used to.
So you do that, and you don't want it to turn out in the negative way because you've had bad experiences, right?
So, like, you know, and that was the key point when he said when he was younger, it might have gone farther. And that's true because, you know, in life experiences.
Well, wait, what's your first name?
Ronaldo.
Ronaldo, let me ask you something. One thing you might say is that you're afraid of the failures. And hypothetically, we could also say, and I mean, I'm sure you'll agree with me, that it's highly possible that we're also reluctant to make the success happen. Because if you don't go the distance, you know, you can never find the success. You know, even though you can't find the failure, you can't find the success. But you have a life experience of knowing what that's about. And in your mind, it comes around as, yep, I don't want to deal with the rejection and the failure that happens, so I kind of quit in the middle. Well, I'll bet you by the end of next week you see it differently. And I'll make you bet there's going to be something that's going to change in you. Stick with me. I've got Ronaldo and Ensor working and Mitch working so far. 2793400, Armand DeMille, you're on the air.
Yes. I'm the only person that my thesis advisor said both completed and didn't complete their PhD dissertation. And this is back in 1988. I successfully defended it. I didn't have to make any revisions, but he pushed me into defending it before I had finished all the notes and the citations and the bibliography, and it's still not finished. I don't have my diploma.
What's your name?
Diane.
Diane? PhD in what?
Anthropology.
In anthropology? Physical or cultural?
Cultural.
Cultural anthropology. Uh-huh. And so he had done this dissertation. What was the topic of your dissertation, by the way, just out of curiosity, since I'm an anthropology hobbyist?
The topic was, sounds very technical and academic, but it's really very germane to today. It was on gender and kinship in prehistoric societies in Northwest Europe in tribal times.
No kidding. Sounds interesting. It doesn't sound so technical. Right? Was it interesting?
Totally fascinating.
Totally fascinating. But they were going to, you had to complete this. Then you had to back it up with bibliography. Then you had to do, I remember mine, get ready for this. My thesis was the effects of acetoxycyclohexamide on learning patterns in Charles River breeding mice in one trial studies. How could that possibly be interesting, acetoxycyclohexamide? It was. But then came this other thing where if you pushed it one more step, if you took it the distance, you would have gotten a PhD, and you would have been Dr. Diane, right?
That's right.
And Dr. Diane would have been, who would have been proud, your mom or your dad? Who would have been prouder of you?
Well, they're both dead, so it doesn't really...
Okay, but who would have been prouder of you, you know, if they were alive?
Actually... it's hard to say. My mother would have been jealous.
Right, okay.
Oh, she has her own doctorate, but she really...
She certainly didn't want anybody else to get a doctorate if she's got a doctorate.
Oh, my father would have been proud in a general way, but it really wasn't that important.
So somehow Mom snuck in there and said to you, or it looks like Mom snuck in there and said, hey, kitty, stay where you belong, will you? I mean, masters we could accept, but no other doctors in the house.
I guess that's true.
Right, you know, and especially somebody who studies gender and kinship. Here you are, mother to daughter, right? And the kinship between you and your daughter. You and your mom. I mean, it's kind of obvious, but it's not so obvious. I'll make you a bet that it was the best thing you ever did in your life.
And what was the best thing?
Not completing that PhD.
Oh.
I'll make you a bet. And again, I'm just collecting the information now, but I'm going to keep your name, Diane, and I'm going to keep coming back to the example of you over the next 2 weeks. I'd like to show you how I think that there's something in you that knows more than you know. All right? And in fact, what I want you to do, Let me see. Here's we're going to try a new format here at BAI. Want you and Ronaldo and Sarah and Mitch to call my office and leave your phone number there. And when we're doing the show, as I get to your issue, I'm going to have us call you if you're there. Okay, so call my office, 212-757-4488. And then I will call you back as we start looking at this over the next couple of weeks. It's a new format here at BAI. Don't leave your phone number here at WBAI. They can't take those phone numbers. Call my office and leave your phone number. And I'll be getting back to all of you. Okay, now, I'm going to take one more caller. We need five examples. Hi there, you're on the air. This is Armand DeMille. Hello. Hi there, you're on the air. This is Armand DeMille.
Oh, hi, Armand.
Yes.
Hi, my name is Joe.
Okay, Joe, and let me save the other people who are calling some trouble right now. You could all hang up because we're not going to take calls for another 15 minutes except for Joe. Okay? And I want to save you guys that so you don't just hang on the phone and hope. Because, you know, hoping and having disappointment with me, you don't need that. Hi, Joe. Go ahead.
Hi. I don't know how you deal about people who are, like myself, who I think are continually putting obstacles in their own way.
Mm-hmm.
That part of the discussion.
Yes, that's exactly the discussion, yes.
Because I'm very successful in my career in terms of what I do,
mm-hmm.
but I believe I can, I'm always putting myself into situations where I'm not completing the last step like some of your other callers have said, or...
Do you do this in relationships too, Joe? My smeller is that in personal relationships you don't do too well.
You mean, emotionally with, family and so on?
No, mostly with mate kind of people.
What kind?
Mate kind of people.
No, I believe I'm doing all right that way.
You're doing all right that way?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Okay, my mistake.
But,
How about with the family?
In any case, it's just a career, you know, career kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
There were instances where, you know, I've been invited to, accept or submit applications for faculty positions at, colleges, and I just couldn't quite, you know, get the last stuff together to, you know, to be considered, or, you know, I'd leave something out that I subconsciously knew I needed to put in.
Yeah, I know what you mean, and then suddenly you don't get this, your next step up in order to be get a faculty position, even though everything else you're doing is good, you somehow don't put in that work and you don't get that next step up. Something in you seems to stop you from going the distance.
And day to day, just a matter of those things that would promote my career, day-to-day, writing letters, making contacts.
Mm-hmm. I understand it completely.
I'm not doing nearly enough.
Joe, stick with me. I want you to give your phone number to my office, 212-757-4488, and we will use you five people. And what you're talking about is part of the example of what we're going to be talking about for the next couple of weeks. Okay, we'll try a new format here at BAI. Okay.
Great, appreciate it.
Sure. There. This is Armand DeMille again with you. Yes, let me see. Yes. Now we're going into the second part of this. You may find the call is irritating, but really, if you listen and listen closely, you're going to identify yourself. Remember, we're talking about narcissism. Is the attachment to an image of what you are. When everybody's a child, when you're a child, you find out that your emotions are inconvenient to those who are in charge. And so what you do is you create an image of somebody who could be loved, a picture. You find out you're going to be a fireman and people will love you. You're going to have dogs love you. You'll become a veterinarian. You're going to look a certain way. But it's all about getting loved. So you create this image of who you are, and this becomes the template of your life. And for the rest of your life, you're living up to this image of who you are, but it's not a real self, because what's missing is the emotions that you did not allow yourself. We're going to continue with part two of this, which is really still the second side of the audio tape.
You are listening Radio on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial.
Hi there, Armand DeMille back with you with The Positive Mind. With you every Wednesday at 1 o'clock. Today talking about part of the secrets to success, which I call the drummer of the gifted child. And the gifted child being all of you out there who, you know, just stood a little apart from the crowd when you were young. In one way or another, you know. Because I'm telling the story about what happened back in 1987 because I like to give it as a personal example. About a moment that happens that each of us kind of tap into where we get a choice. So I'm going back to the event of this health expo. I'm hoping all now you were there and getting impatient, told a joke, made this funny joke, nobody laughed at it, everybody wrote it down, and I suddenly started saying, oh my gosh, we're all in trouble. Not just me, but all of you are in trouble if you're writing down what I say, because what am I doing? I'm just talking. Why are you listening? It's only an idea. So I said to myself, it's happening, I'm becoming a star. I don't have as much time for friends as I used to, I realize. This is all flashing through my mind. I'm hiring lawyers and accountants to protect myself for the future. I'm setting up retirement plans. So I stopped. 1987, I stopped. I stopped everything. I grabbed hold of myself and picked a target date and promised myself that I would stop. It wasn't an impulse. Because I didn't like who I was becoming, and if success afforded me anything, it was the right to take some time off to find out where I intended to take this all, and boy, I'm sure glad I did. So I guess you hear me building my premise here. What we often call self-destructive behavior may not be that at all. In fact, it may be the opposite. Self-sabotage may be the best thing you could do. If you're sabotaging a self that's not really you. Did I just write a poem? Try it again. Self-sabotage may be the best thing you could do if you're sabotaging a self that's not really you. Now, I'm not really going to be able to go the distance with this issue today because in order to go this distance, I'm going to want to share with you some of the wisdom that comes out of a fabulous discovery by Alice Miller, which is kind of what happened. In order to take this further, I want you to tune in next week. And if you can't plan to have that have the show taped, you know, if yourself, call my office for a tape. Because next week, I'm going to go into all the details and how we set these life goals, who we set them for, what a real self is as opposed to a narcissistic self, and how do you stay true to yourself. And if you want to follow me through this next week, and the following weeks, you know, you don't have to, but you could pick up the book by Alice Miller. She's a psychiatrist from Europe. The name of the book is called The Drama of the Gifted Child. And if you'd rather not, just don't. You know, I'll present it all to you. I'll present my interpretation of what Alice Miller means. Because that's what I did back in 1987. I quit everything. I stopped all the machines, not all at once, because that's an impulse, you know, and I don't trust my impulses. I said, okay, if I'm willing to do this, I'm willing to do it some time from now. I stopped all the machines. I made a plan for 6 months from that date and told everyone I was stopping for a while. I was stopping because I didn't know what I was becoming, and I didn't like the picture. I didn't particularly know if that's what I wanted to become. And then I read Alice Miller's book, The Drama of the Gifted Child, a page or two a day. I remember I had a little shack at the beach, and it was a tiny little shack, and I remember I said to myself, okay, the one thing you won't do is work while you're here. You're just going to look at yourself. Now, my friend Dieter Scheid, many of you have heard, he has this little place in Poce in Italy where people go there and they just stay silent for a couple of weeks. Well, that was kind of what I was doing. It wasn't really silent, but I was quiet. And I refused to do anything creative, which for me is virtually impossible because I could pick up sand and wonder how sand could be used as a therapeutic tool, you know. But I promised myself nothing creative and no work. Just look at yourself. See, I was clearly a gifted child all the time. I was born in the slums of New York.
into a very impoverished family, but somehow I always stood out from the crowd. In almost everything I did, I seemed to do a little better than the people around me. And I had a lifetime of successes. But the question really was, what is it all about? What was I becoming? What did I hope to become? Here's my question for you. What are you about? What are you becoming? What do you hope to become? What did you used to hope to become? A metaphysician the other day, a guy who's a pain specialist. That's what he does. He helps people through pain, knows a lot about it. And I sat and I talked to him, and I recognized him. I recognized he and I were about the same age, so we talked about where we came from. We both came from the same neighborhood. And we talked about growing up in Greenwich Village, you know, our teenage and young adult years, which was one interesting party. And watching Bob Dylan playing spoons at the cafe, you know, and things like that, which was kind of an exciting time, as a lot of you BAI people remember, because BAI was born just about that time. And I was talking to him, and we talked about the folks who were all just right there, protesting and fighting the war, and hippies at the time, and really standing against everything that was too much of a constriction on man's being. And they all kind of gathered up in Woodstock, then they hung out in Woodstock, and now all those folks own homes in Woodstock, or two homes in Woodstock, and they have to meet the mortgages as they drive down in their four-track vehicles. You know, it's kind of like now they're worried about all the stuff that they used to mock, and they're being that thing. And that doesn't mean they're wrong, but is that a choice, or did they just slide into that? Do you just slide into your future, or is it ever a time to stop? Well, that's what happened to me. 1987, best thing I ever did. I stopped for almost a year, I remember. I thought I was just quitting forever until I could find out something about what I wanted. And when I came back real differently. I came back with a lot more heart. Even though I looked like I always had the heart, I came back with a lot more heart. So when you get swept up in the sweet smell of success, you tend not to ask your question. Not to ask yourself the question, who am I? What am I becoming? What did I want to become? Is this it? And, well, there's an old book. I'll read you one more thing. Then we'll take your calls. There's an old book that many BAIers grew up on. It was the first real New Age book by Carlos Castaneda, Tales of Power. It was like, you know, the hippie, what's the new one I was talking about last week? Right, Celestine Prophecy. There it is, right. The first Celestine Prophecy was probably the Tales of Power. Now, here's a contribution from that book that I really value. I don't agree with it completely because the heart can lead you astray. This talks about the heart leading you in places. Functioning on impulse is different than functioning from the heart, and it often gets confused. And as Carl Sagan says, you know, the smaller brain animals are almost always motivated by impulse, while the larger brain mammals are dominated by their brain. You know, that our really basic function is to function from impulse, and many people think that's called functioning from the heart. But here's a selection from that book that I kind of carry with me. And I'd like you to hear it, so I'm going to read it to you. And remember, the parts, I don't agree with it completely, but it's kind of beautiful, and maybe you should hear it. And this is called Finding the Path with the Heart. And here's the way it goes. Anything we do is one of a million paths. Therefore, you should always keep in mind that a path is only a path. If you feel you should not follow it, you must not stay with it under any conditions. Now, to have such clarity, you must lead a disciplined life. Only then will you know that any path is only a path, and there's no affront to oneself or to others in dropping it, if that's what your heart tells you to do. But your decision to keep on the path or to leave it must be free of fear or ambition. I warn you, he says. I warn you, look at every path closely and deliberately. Try it as many times as you think necessary, then ask yourself and yourself alone one question. And this is one question that only a very old person eventually asks. And my benefactor, he said, told me about it once when I was too young and my blood was too vigorous for me to understand it. But now I understand it. And I'll tell you what it is. Does this path, does this thing you're doing, does it have a heart?
All paths are the same. They lead nowhere. They're paths going through the bush or into the bush. And in my own life, I could say I've traversed long, long paths, but I am not anywhere. My benefactor's question has a meaning now. Does this path have a heart? If it does, the path is good. If it does not, it's of no use. You see, both paths lead nowhere, but one has a heart and the other does not. One makes for a joyous journey. As long as you follow it, you are one with it. The other one makes you curse your life. One makes you strong, the other weakens you. The trouble is, nobody asks the question, and when a man finally realizes that he has taken a path without a heart, the path is ready to kill him. At that point, very few people can stop and deliberate and leave the path. So a path without a heart is never enjoyable. You have to work hard even to take it. On the other hand, a path with a heart is easy. It does not make you work at liking it. For me, there's only traveling on paths that have a heart, or on any path that may have a heart. So there I travel, and the only worthwhile challenge is to traverse its full length. And there I travel, looking, looking, breathlessly. That's by Carlos Castaneda. So this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind, rambling a bit, not taking you to any direct end, but kind of setting the stage for our discussions about your successes and where you intend to take your successes, or whether you intend to stay with what you're doing, and maybe if you've shaken one or two, we want to hear from you. What is it that you've done in your life where you felt you were at a pinnacle? And don't give me the reason that you stopped, but tell me what you did that you thought was self-sabotaging or that you thought was in some way injurious to yourself. What did you do, the mistake you made at the pinnacle of a relationship or of a thing? What decision did you make that threw you off course? Let's hear from you now. 279-3400. I've been talking long enough. Let's hear from you guys. Hi there, you're on the air. And gals.
Armand, this is Carolyn, and I know my heart loves you. You. And the program is so perfect. This has been the work for me. I experienced a success for some years in my work, and I restore heirloom gowns and gained a lot of notoriety from it. The thing that happened, I think now, doing the work, is I looked at my background to see the drama. There was a lot of drama with the success because there was so much was needed from me. The media exposure gave me an overwhelming amount of work came my way, and I found that I was in the same drama as when I was a child, and I didn't know that that was the unconscious drive to need to be seen, need to have more, to be more kind of stuff, and I bottomed out. I had adrenal burnout from it, and I have been grieving that identity that was attached to the success, the power, the money that it had given me. I don't have any of that now, and sometimes I was just saying before your program came on to someone, I feel like I'm hanging on a rope, and that rope is the identity to what I was, because there was a book opportunity there for me, and I started to do the groundwork.
I understand. Let me ask you something. Are you 47 years old yet?
I'm 49. Yesterday, last week. I'm an Aquarius.
Right. You know, this is the question. The question you're asking is a question that the average 47-year-old asks, so you're younger than your age. The question is, you look back in time and you say, okay, there I had it in my hands and I kind of let it slide through. And now that things are getting rough, like you're saying, your adrenals are shot, you know. Now that things are getting rough, what you're doing is you're looking back and you're saying, see, right there, if I had ridden that crest, I might have been better off. That's at one level. And I say you might not have been. You might not be the person you are today. Now, I'm just not trying to make good out of it because I want to explain the whole thing, and I'll be going into a lot of it next week. Let me ask you something. Was your mom sick?
I just came to maybe she was attention deficit disorder. There was total chaos. She was absent working two jobs. and I'm the oldest of six, so I was the caretaker of six children, and my stepfather was terribly in depression.
So you were kind of holding everything together, everything that was kind of endowed. So you, in effect, would take the tapestry of your family and keep repairing it and repairing it and repairing it, right? There you were, you know, the restoring the heirloom gown of your family. Because you had to take care of your mom, you had an alcoholic father, and you had all these young kids. And there you were sewing it together and sewing it together and making it nice and making it nice and spending your life making it nice. And you took that heritage of being the fixer in the family, the seamstress, the family seamstress, and you turned it into a profession. And then a moment came where you received all these accolades, and you said, the people said, oh boy, you could write a book about this, and you said, wait a minute, I don't want to be this. I want to be something else. And a part of you stood up for you and said, leave it. Leave it behind. Don't become this. Because if you become it, that's going to be your role for life.
Armand, but now I'm living out that other stuff. I hear you. It's the metaphor. Yes, it is the story of my life. You are right on. But there were debts, big-time emotional debts and financial debts that I was humiliated by them, owing everybody and hiding out and lying. And this is, like, happening.
Didn't you hide
it? It's against my integrity. I always thought I was
didn't you have to do that when you were a kid, too?
How did I get myself into these financial debts? Is this the metaphor that I must look at my emotional debt?
Yes, because there's a thing happening here. Now, weren't you lying about your mother and father, too? Your mother was at loose ends. Your father was an alcoholic. Right? How did you keep the balance with the kids? When the kids would rebel, weren't there a certain role in you that was creating untruths all the way when you were a kid? You had to in order to keep the balance going. If everybody knew the truth, it would have been chaos.
Yeah.
So that part of you, that same thing was all part of that. And I understand it's real uncomfortable where you are. I'm not trying to make you feel comfortable for where you are. I'm just saying that perhaps if we could take the regret off that past and say, okay, I bailed out. I bailed out with some trouble, and I've still got the troubles. But if you could go back and do it all over again, would you do it? Would you go back on that crest? Would you go back to being the famous heirloom restoring gowns person?
Go back to that.
Do you want that?
Well, I have a button. Admire the person.
Okay, now hold on a minute. I have a button here at WBAI. They have the wish granting button, which I see here in front of me.
Oh.
And if you want, I could press this button, and you can be the famous heirloom gown restorer with exactly the lifestyle that you had back then. What? Are you ready? Because I've got the button right here. I hear you. You regret it. Ready? Shall we? Are you ready, Matthew? Are we gonna?
No.
I'm about. What'd you say?
No.
Say it again.
No!
Well, it's a good thing. I think you're saying I shouldn't press the button. Because, you know, it's a funny thing. Sometimes, for sometimes, when people live in regrets, you know, and they're living in regrets, you give them the opportunity to have it back, you know, they would jump at it. And I somehow hear inside of you that whatever it is, whatever that hell was, it stopped at one point. Is that right? Are you still there?
Yeah.
I like your no.
It took the family. The crisis.
Yeah.
Crisis bottomed me out. My brother was fighting for his life with his disease.
Yep.
Mother was fighting for her life with her disease. There was disease all around me, and I was hanging in my little isolated studio, trying to hang on there, restoring one gown after the other, looking up at the sky and wishing I wasn't there. It was too painful down here on Earth. I just wanted to fly up into my fantasy world. You know, maybe rescue the world single-handedly, be a humanitarian, and take away the diseases of the planet. You know, it was like getting so out of hand, you know.
Yeah. Now,
and that energy, you know, all that energy inside of me, just sitting on my butt, restoring, feeling I wasn't really doing anything.
What's your name?
Carolyn.
Carolyn, you sound like a wonderful person to me. I'm so glad you made the decision you made, number one. And number two, I'm glad you're on our team. Whatever our team is, I'm glad you're on our team because you're one hell of a fighter. And so, to you, happy birthday.
Oh, thank you. I love you, Armand, and thank you for your story. Your story was what I needed today. your story, what you do, when you, I identify with that, I said, I'm okay. The disease doesn't own me anymore. I'm okay.
Make sure you hang in with me the next few weeks.
I will
be. It'll get more interesting. Thanks a lot, Carolyn. 2793400, I'm on DeMille. You're on the air. Hi.
Oh, it's great to be on the air. I guess there's a lot of things that I regret. Some of them I see as good things that I did. The thing that I keep regretting is that I keep on doing a performance and then hiding for like a year before I do another one.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't get anywhere.
Are you an actress?
I'm a performance artist. I create my own material and perform it.
What do you do?
It's a combination of dance and theater from things that I've written. I take, like, notes during my life, and then I kind of put them together.
And then you put it up on stage?
Yeah.
And you put it out there somewhere, and then people like it, and then you hide out, and you don't get back
to
doing it?
Yeah, then I freak out.
You're like the book writer who never does a second book?
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, I find, you know, and it's like, people are supportive. They say, oh, when are you going to do your next thing, you know, and I just... I don't know what it is. Okay,
well, let's take a look at that.
And then I just, when I'm not doing it, I get very unhappy, and I just go over things that I should have been forgotten, whether it's conversations with people who've critiqued my work, who haven't liked it, or, you know, other just personal things with friendships that I just go over and over. I get completely obsessed, and one of the things about my work is that I kind of make humor of all that.
What's your name?
Alice.
Alice, you know, in all of this time, you spent a lot of time being self-critical, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're self-critical, and therefore anybody who's self-critical is depressed, which I know, all right? You don't have to tell me. So you live with a kind of depression and self-criticism most of the time.
Yeah, I fight it very hard, though.
Right? And you make a war against it.
I really do.
And
I've actually been very successful.
I can imagine. You must have come from a much deeper, darker place than you are now.
I have a mother who's extremely depressed, who I relate to too much.
Were you one of the people who were in Philadelphia in 1987 in the audience? Because I saw some awfully depressed, dark people there.
No, I would have taken... one thing is I have a good sense of humor. I would have laughed.
You would have known it was a joke. I didn't tell...
I hope so.
I didn't tell my second
not,
joke.
But I
was supposed
so.
To tell my second joke today. I'll tell it next week. Okay, now here's what you're saying. You're saying you have a major battle. You come out of a depressive, self-critical, dysfunctional family, and you are fighting this battle. And success in this materialistic world, on that stage and stuff, would have given you a kind of sense of yourself that people would have projected as success, but inside you would have felt not successful still. Your body was saying to you, not yet, Alice, not yet. Not yet, because we're not ready for it yet. We're not ready to step up there as a star when we still feel so terrible about ourselves. Because in order for us to do it, and Alice, I was right with you back in 87, we would have to become so plastic. We would have to make ourselves into somebody we're not. When somebody walks up to you in the street and they see you as a great artist, you have to be a great artist in the street every moment. When they pass you by and they see you, you have to be that great thing every moment. So you could have stepped up and become this plastic Alice who wasn't ready to be Alice yet. And instead something said to you, nope, I'm not ready yet.
I don't know if it's being plastic. I think it's just the enormous commitment and dealing with people that I just couldn't handle.
Well, that's kind of what I mean by plastic. Because
I don't think the downtown world is that plastic. It has its own...
No, but plastic, I don't mean plastic.
It has its own...
I'm sorry, plastic isn't glad. Plastic is just a creation that's not necessarily organically real, you know? And I think you've been invested in finding who you are, and I think the major goal in your life has been survival and reconstruction and getting yourself to a place where you feel in balance. And I'm saying that at that time, if you kind of just popped on that thing and become more and more just popular and famous and popular and famous, you would have never had a chance to do the work you did on yourself.
I wish I could believe that.
Okay, well, stick with me, and I'm going to present to you Alice, thanks because you did, because Alice Miller's book. Have you read The Prisoners of Childhood?
No, but I'm going
the
away.
The Drama of the Gifted Child.
I want to bring a book, so I was thinking...
Well, that's not a book for entertainment, but it's a serious book. It's a down book. Bring two books. Bring The Celestine Prophecy and bring Alice Miller's Prisoners of... It's called The Drama of the Gifted Child.
Uh-huh.
Two books. And then get the next tape that I do on this show if you're going away. Where are you going?
I'm going to Atlanta.
Okay. Okay, no, we don't have our, we're not broadcasting Atlanta yet, right?
No.
But make sure you tune in and get a copy of what we're doing next week, because I'm going to go further into it. And I think you'll see after I'm finished.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting, because I combine it with what you said last week about identifying with a parent.
Right.
I feel part of my not wanting to be successful is identifying with my mother, who sort of wrote poetry and put it in a box.
Oh, exactly.
So I think both things can go on at the same time.
I do, too. This is Armand DeMille. I have to get going. 2793400. We have time for one more caller, don't we, Matthew? Matthew? Okay, it's going to have to be a fast call. Hi, you're on the air with me.
Hi. I just wanted to tell you, to thank you for reading that Castellanos.
Yeah.
You read Where I Am and what I was thinking about, and it gave me a great deal of hope, and it made me understand what it was that I was headed towards. And I felt the greatest joy and happiness with myself where I was. Thank you.
Well, it's my pleasure. If you want a copy of today's show, you can call 212-757-4488 and have that poem forever. This is Armand DeMille. I'll be back with you next week, picking up on the drama of The Gifted Child. Hope you've enjoyed my story. I'll tell you the other jokes next week. Bye-bye for now.
This is the end, friends. This is the
my friends.
This is the end of this CD. So this is side two. Now you can move on to the next.